I'll tell you what, I enjoyed it too, because I love when he starts, you know, talking about horses and in the 80s, and he comes up with the names, and you come up with the names, and you stroll down memory lane. Really, it just sparks so much interest in me. It sparks so much interest in me because of two reasons. I was galloping horses this morning, and of course, the first one, the wind was up his upper tail in the cool temperatures, and she ran off like 3/4 of a mile with me. And went past a bunch of people on the outside fence. And if you don't look like they're running off, they think that's what you want the horse to do. So I got her around there, went back, told the trainer, your horse ran off 3/4 of a mile. Nothing I could do about it. Everybody else thought that's what we wanted to do, 2-minute liquor, run off a little ways. And I went past a guy coming home on my next horse, Joey Ambezi. And Joey Ambezi's been in the game forever. His dad was in the game. And Briardale Farm, Ambezi. And it just sparked some interest in me when you were talking about, you know, things that happened in the past. I went upstairs when I got home, and I saw a picture that my uncle had given me many years ago, and was the Frisette Stakes, graded stakes in the early 60s, like 63. I don't know. It was $100,000.
Well, I don't think they weren't even really graded then. I mean, there wasn't even officially a grading.
Okay. I didn't even see. I learned something already just listening to you. But then I got a picture upstairs. It's Briardale Farm, and Joe Mergler was the trainer, and Joe Ambezi, who I went past this morning, the son of the Joe Ambezi that was the original Briardale Farm, he had commented on how my horse went, the one that was running off. And I said, yeah, Joe, she really went good. But I'm looking at this picture, and I'm saying, here's a picture of real interest. Did you know that Belmont races were run at Aqueduct in 63? And it says Frisette Stakes, Belmont Park, run at Aqueduct, $119,000. And I'm thinking, maybe Steve knows why. Was there construction going on?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Back to back. There was the period where Belmont was rebuilt, and then Aqueduct was rebuilt. And so the seasons were transferred over, and there's countless. There's Jockey Club Gold Cup run at Aqueduct. In fact, I put up the picture, Jockey Club Gold Cup week, I'm pretty sure. If I go to our website and our handicapping, I had the picture of what's it? It must be Kelso's fourth. Must be his fourth Gold Cup.
Yeah.
Let me see here. I'll tell you right away because I here it is right here. Let me go to it and I'll put this up too so people can see it on Twitter. Seventh race, the Jockey Club Gold Cup, first Kelso, and this was 1960. So it was earlier than that then. It was
right,
earlier
was
than his.
The picture I have is of Tosma, and she's winning the Frisette Stakes from at Belmont at Aqueduct in October of 63. So I figured that's what it must have been, construction between they swapped dates. Just to accommodate the construction at one track or the other.
Well, it was 4 years. I think 4 years. Either was it 4 years for Aqueduct, 3 years for Belmont. I mean, it was an extended period. I mean, absolutely.
And here I was looking at this picture, and I'm thinking, I just saw Joey Ambezi, the son of the Briardale Farm, the originator of the Briardale Farm, his dad, and we always used to kid because. Not too long ago, I was at Parks and I saw Joe Ambezi, the son, you know, and I said, Joe, who used to train for your dad? He said, Mergler, Joe Mergler. They used to nickname him Mergler, and this was a no reflection on his way of doing business, but it was just because it rhymed. They would say Mergler.
The burglar.
Mergler. Yeah. No reflection on his business, but my uncle rode a lot for him, and this horse, Tosma, was a really nice filly.
Sure she was.
And I got a picture of her because my uncle had some stuff he was, you know, going through, and I just wanted to have pictures of my uncle because he rode up to 67, started in 48, ended in 67. And when you started walking that, taking that stroll down memory lane with Haskin and mentioning Broad Rush, and I rode Broad Rush a couple times, and then I got hurt and never rode him after that. But I rode him in his maiden race and in his A other than allowance race, and then he tried bolting that day with me, but he was just learning how to bolt, I guess, because he really bolted in the Pennsylvania Derby with Cordero, and it looked like there was no way he was going to recover that day when he bolted at the quarter pole in the Pennsylvania Derby, and Angel got him back in hand and got his mind back on running, and he still won the Derby in spite of giving up the lead at the head of the lane. But yeah, it's really interesting when you guys start talking, because you come up with so many interesting facts, and it just sparks a lot of memories in me.
And I've got it here, Tony. The 1960, his first one, Kelso at Aqueduct in the slop, actually, and then came back in 61 at Aqueduct. 62 was, they were able to run it at Belmont, and then 63 and 64 were back at Aqueduct.
Yeah, and that's what this picture of Tosmo was at Aqueduct, and it was 63. It's amazing how the game has adjusted at times when it had to, and gone through transitions and construction, and we take a lot of that for granted. Racing, it's a great sport, and of course in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, I was introduced to it in the 50s, late 50s. I realized my uncle was a jockey, you know. I was born in 51. By 59, I really started knowing what being a jockey was, It's just an amazing sport, and it was, as a kid, I can remember going to school, and your first or second grade teacher would say to you when you walked in the room, "How'd your uncle do yesterday? Garden State was running," you know, and it's amazing how the game is. They used to have Tommy Roberts on the radio, and we did a feature from Garden State. It is a popular sport, but it had so much more exposure back then, and it was just neat to be a little kid, and your uncle was a jockey, and you'd go to school, and your second grade teacher, you know, him or her, say, how did Uncle Sam do yesterday? And it was just really neat. It was a great area to grow up in. And, you know, and being at Garden State, you know, we've lived around here since I was born, and my uncle lived right down the street. And every time I go to the shopping complex, I can't help but to think I've walked through this area, the shopping complex. I walked through it, and I wonder what barn this was, or I wonder what part of the racetrack this was. You know, and I can't help but to think that. And I'm thinking, boy, Black, you're really turning into an old son of a gun. But racing's been so good to me, and I really appreciate it. Even when a horse, I get on my first horse this morning, and I only got on three, but it's amazing how these horses respond to the wind and the cool temperatures. And I'm thinking to myself, here people say, we make these horses. You know, the people that knock us, you make these horses run. And I'm thinking, boy, you never watched one of them train, you idiot. Because these horses love what they're doing. When you get out there in the morning and one gets the wind up their back and their tails up over their back, and they're just loving to buck and play, and you're on their back hoping that they go straight because you're on their back and you want to get on their back and stay on their back so you can get them home. And I'm thinking, boy, if you ever watch these horses buck and play and enjoy what they're doing, you'd never make that statement that you make these horses do this. Jeez. How little do they know?
Well, Tony, I spent that part of that segment with Steve thumbing through racing manuals, and I as you talked and I pulled you up in one of them, and according to this, you were born right there in Mount Holly.
Right there, Mount Holly Hospital. And you know, when you got to talking about Keeneland, and Steve was talking about Keeneland, and it brought back memories of Keeneland, and you know, I can remember my first look at it when I went down there for a week to ride some horses from Mrs. Paxton, and Mrs. Paxton had some nice horses. In fact, I won the Ashland Stakes, one of the first races I won at Keeneland, and a maiden two-year-old race she had. And I'll never forget when we pulled up. Don't know what the roads were, but he had mentioned it. And you see the beautiful four-rail white fence of Calumet Farm. you know, and you when you're driving from Bluegrass Airport to the track, and that beautiful four rail fence. You know, six rails ain't enough. We got four rail white fence, and it's just beautiful horse country. And I had the pleasure of riding down there and spending a week. I guess it was in the late 70s, and it was just such an enjoyable week. Didn't go down there to ride for anybody but Mrs. Paxson. Only rode a couple races there, and both of them that I remember that I won. Maybe rode a few others. And then one other time I went back to Keeneland in 81, and I won a prep that they used for the Kentucky Derby or whatever it was. Jerry Myers had a horse, Classic Go-Go, and he won a race at Keeneland. I forget what the race was. It was like the Forerunner or the Lexington, or I don't know what the name of the race was. But it was just a neat place, and it was truly the horse racing capital, you know, just to see the beautiful farms. And, you know, you went out at night and ate and came back and drove past these beautiful farms. And I'm thinking, who wouldn't want to go on a tour to see what horse racing really is about, and what breeding and the beautiful mares and the stallions and what they're exposed to, the beauty and the care and everything, the love of racing that is displayed by everyone who goes to that track. And I mean, and you had young kids, because there would be a day that they entertained the college kids or the young people.
Yeah, they're still very big. It's very big.
Yeah, it's big. And then you think, man, this is what racing, it really, when you go to Keeneland or you go to an event like that, it really renews your whole outlook on horse racing and what a beautiful sport it really is.
Well, I think Steve's publicity for, you know, for these tours, and also, you know, there is the initiative that several of the farms put together. It's got to be now, probably it's almost 5 years, I'd bet. You know, the Horse Country initiative, and you know, Michael Blowen is part of this too, with the, you know, with the aftercare portion, and, you know, creating a destination, the whole horse tourism concept that, you know, really, you're right, is a perfect complement to everything else that goes on, and particularly, you know, the racing product, the afternoons.
Yeah, my hat's off to these guys. I mean, they do a lot to put the word out there what racing's really about, and then they go to the next level and they actually show you, you know, these places and these beautiful farms. And, you know, it's really, like I said, it renews your whole outlook on racing. And Keeneland, what a beautiful track. The beautiful grandstand and the gray stone construction. And what better place could you go to introduce somebody to racing?
No, listen, had this discussion a little bit yesterday to some degree with Alex Lieblong, and, you know, he identified the boutique meets in general that, you know, that have been the best sources of success for the game. I mean, the big days, obviously, Triple Crown and Breeders' Cup, but then when you fold in Oaklawn and Saratoga, Del Mar, the two Keeneland meets, and, you know, and technically a place like, you know, Fairgrounds is seasonal and has got its, you know, certainly its footing is very much reestablished after, you know, a little bit of a fishtail period. Tampa, I mean, a place like Tampa is a successful hotbed. You know, there's no, I mean, yes, there's areas where there's some real uncertainty, you know, Chicagoland, currently the concern, and we're really not sure where things go long term in New England, you know, but to, you know, you don't want to have marketplaces that size without a live racing product, you know, for people to basically get introduced to the game. But, you know, when you connect the dots to those successful boutique-y seasons and you know, then the highlights in terms of, you know, the biggest weekends of the year, you've got something very solid to work from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and these big weekends, I mean, we all appreciate the Derby, Preakness, Belmont, and then we come up to the Breeders' Cup, and, you know, maybe doesn't have the tremendous tradition that Derby Preakness and Belmont has, but it has the great horses and you know, and it's getting its history. You know, it's, you can't go back 100 years, but you can sure go back many years to where it first started. What was the first Breeders' Cup? Was it
Hollywood, 84. Hollywood at 84. And then Akron, yeah, 85.
Right, and I mean, and it's gaining tradition, and it's getting the understanding that every year these are the best horses, not just in the country, sometimes internationally, they're the best horses that anyone could have an eye on, and everyone would have the opportunity of watching on the Breeders' Cup Day. And, you know, it's great to see people really start to anticipate, man, it's around the corner. You know, we're going to have Breeders' Cup in a few weeks. And then they, you know, they, some of them have watched the horses run in some of these prep races, you know. And, of course, you get the publicity where some of them have run, some of them are going to have rider changes, or some of them are going to be critical of how they ran last time. And riders and trainers, maybe you'll say, throw that race out, you know, because it was more of a prep first work for the Breeders' Cup. Even like, you know, the controversy came up with rider change, and I was surprised when they came up with rider change, even though riders get used to that, with Mackenzie and Mike Smith, because Mike Smith came down the stretch like this was the prep for the Breeders' Cup race. He couldn't do anything about it after he got to the quarter pole and tried. That horse was obviously going to win. You weren't going to go around and beat him. Maybe if he didn't follow instructions, that was the bug that, that's what bugged Baffert. But you know what? I thought he rode him like a true professional when he finally realized he can't beat that horse. I might as well let him come
wrap
down
up
the stretch and,
yeah,
and not beat him up. Wasn't you could beat him up and you still are not going to beat that horse. You know, it's just the way it's,
yeah,
the race transpired. Once you don't do something the first 3/8 of a mile in that race or the first quarter mile and the race starts setting up like it's set up, it's too late to adjust by the time you get midway down the backside. So you might as well sit and hope that that horse comes apart that's on the lead. And if he doesn't, you ain't going to catch him. So why beat this horse up just to be second and beat up when you're going to be second and not beat him up? And the race will serve as a tremendous prep for the Classic. You know, that's the way I looked at it. But maybe that's a jockey point of view. And, of course, that trainer had a different point of view. But that's what the game's made of. It's made up of opinions and points of view. And,
yeah,
you know, everybody's got one.
Well,
that
and Tony,
to be mine.
Well, it's a germane point, and even though it's well after the fact that this change happened, explain from your perspective and differentiate between sprints and routes. When,
okay,
if you know what I mean, when you know that you have a chance and that to catch a winner, and then, you know, certainly for us as horse players, one of the great frustrations is the impression that somebody, okay, they know they can't win, but hell, there's second, there's third, they pay down
right
to fifth. You know, why isn't a guy basically riding hard no matter really where they are? Talk about that, actually, because it's something I don't think we've really ever brought up.
Well, and I'll tell you what, it's hard to justify it to the eye, but it's not hard to justify it to the person that's on their back. When you realize, and, you know, very rarely are you going to be surprised, you think, man, this horse on the lead, he actually kicked away from me. I asked my horse, he fired, and this horse on the lead kicked away, or I couldn't close the gap. I know I can't close the gap. Reaching and strapping this horse becomes almost, it comes of no effect, has no positive effect on your horse. It doesn't help him accelerate. He's already done that. I'm going to be second, and beating him up isn't going to create anything except maybe a useless abuse to some, let's not call abuse, but just a useless effort that leaves a bad taste in your horse's mouth. Let me explain something to you. When you're riding horses, going long, you have a longer period of time to know when you have horse that, when you have the bit in his mouth and you're relaxed and your horse's ears are flexed. You know, you went around the first turn after you left the gate, you came down the backside, you still got horse, and you look, let's say you're laying just off of the pace or a little ways, you know, a few lengths off the pace. You'll really figure out if you have horse and he's going to respond and kick to the horses that are in front of you, accelerate to the horses that are in front of you, sometime going into like the 3.5, the half mile pole, into that 3/8 pole, maybe into the turn. And usually about the quarter pole, when you reach and hopefully get this horse, you know, change leads, and if so, and you're setting him down for his hard drive, you'll know within 70 yards, is that hard drive from the, as we straightened up down the stretch, is that hard drive enough to catch these horses on the lead? You're not only paying attention to what your horse is doing, but you get a sensation of what the horses in front of you are doing. You can see the ones that are staggering or becoming weak and coming back to you. You can see the one that's hitting that stride. It's in beautiful rhythm, and he is not coming back a lick. And you have accelerated to your utmost, and that acceleration isn't enough to catch him. But you'll feel that. You know, it's hard to explain it, but you'll feel it. And when you feel it, you're 99.9% of the time right. The only thing that'll make that change, not if your horse can accelerate anymore, is if that horse that's in front of you, for some reason, could be physical, it could be, a fitness situation, where he finally collapses. You didn't accelerate anymore to get to him. He collapsed and came back to you. And hitting your horse wasn't going to make you get to him any faster because you went to your optimum acceleration speed. He came back to you. You didn't accelerate to him. There's a difference when horses are coming back and you're accelerating. And then you've accelerated and you're not catching them. The only way you beat them is if they collapse, not because you're accelerating anymore. Now, going short, these decisions, you can tell if you have horse a lot sooner. You know, you leave the gate. Let's say it's going anywhere from 7/8 a mile, 3/4 of a mile, you know. And I love flat mile. You guys were talking about mile around one turn. They're long sprints. I love them kind of races because the more distance that you have around one turn, a lot of times the mindset is, we've got plenty of time to get there. You know what? Most of the time, a mile's like a long sprint. And the horses that have speed or tactical speed, especially if you have speed, you can squeeze them and make them go a mile. I used to love a race at Laurel. They used to run a bend and a turn. It was a bend, a mile bend. It was a bend shoot. And then it would come onto the main track, and you'd go around a turn. And it was like and they would run a mile like that. And every once in a while, they would run a mile and 16th to the second wire like that, a bend, a turn, and to the second ride wire. And you could win it on horses that were quick, that you were squeezing the juice out of them to go that distance, that maybe wouldn't go that distance around two turns, but they'll definitely go that distance around one turn or a bend in a turn. But going short, you usually find out pretty early in the early stages of the race, you know, before you get to the 3/8 pole, do I have horse? Is this horse just pulling on me? Or is he into the bit because is it energy or is it nerve? And there's a big difference when you're riding horses. You know, there's horses that get on the bit, and it's nerves, and there's no acceleration or energy under you. And then there's horses that get on the bit, and it's energy. You know, you're sitting there. Their ears are pricking back and forth. You're sitting on them. You got a nice snug hold of them. You went left the gate. Let's say it's going anywhere 3/4, 6.5. You left the gate. You went down the backside beautifully. We just passed the half-mile pole. You know what? I got the same tension on his reins as I had leaving the gate. When he hits the 3/8 pole, hopefully he'll pop over to his left lead. I still got some tension on these reins and comfort. When I pick my stick up coming to the head of the lane and wave it at him, he accelerates. Mm. I got a horse. There's no better feeling. Pops over to his right lead. He accelerates. And there better be somebody that's on the lead running because you're going to blow by him if they ain't. And that's what horses let you know this. But, you know, you communicate with these horses. Believe me, of course, with your eyeballs, you know, and you're looking at their eyeballs if they don't have blinkers, and you're looking at their ears, of course. You know, their ears tell you a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, their ears are pricked forward. Well, they're looking at something. Their ears are flipping back and forth. They're relaxed and running comfortably. Their ears are pinned back. Something's got them mad, you know. And then when you ask them to accelerate and their ears were pricked back and forth, you wave the stick at them and they take off. They pop over to the right lead. What a beautiful feeling, you know. You got to love it. But horses let you know this. And you then, you don't only just communicate with them with, of course, what you're looking at, your hands and the tension of the reins and the bit in their mouth. You can tell if it's nerves or is it energy. It's a big difference, and that's what hands are on a rider. They can tell if it's nerves, he's just pulling on me, or is it energy? He's relaxed, and he's on the bit, he's snug, and he's just waiting for me to move my hands.
And you, Tony, that's that part we have talked about, and I suppose, and to some degree, this is an experience factor, and you know, as a young rider, it gets more and more experience. I mean, there are guys that and gals that just have a natural feel, but judging how much run you're going to get when you feel that you've got horse, you know, what determines? I mean, they say that you know, a horse can put in, you know, a run a quarter mile, a 3/8. I mean, how do you know how much and how far a horse is going to sustain a bid?
Okay. Well, their acceleration factor comes up when it is determined by how easy they were running in the early stages of the race.
There you go. Okay.
You know, that's what determines their acceleration. And you got a horse, let's say we're going 3/4 mile, and I've been sitting there, and it's not nervous, you know, pulling on the bit nervously. He's energetic and snugging the bit, and he's comfortable. And he lets you know he's comfortable, or she, you know, I just use the word he. Yeah. But they let you know if they're comfortable. You know, they're running along. Their stride is a nice, comfortable, easy stride. Their ears are flicking back and forth, and you got that nice snug on them, the same snug you had leaving there. You got maybe going in a 3/8 hole. Now, you know, when you go around that turn, this horse is really going to give you a hard punch when you set him down at the quarter pole or coming to the head of the stretch, because his energy, he and you reserved his energy and used him efficiently and effectively in the early stages of a race. You know, the old riders used to say, you know, kid, you got to learn that your hands are your way of communicating with these horses. You got to have good hands, good hands, good hands. And, you know, I wasn't a natural. I had to learn things. I wasn't a natural athlete when I was wrestling in high school. I had to learn, you know, what anxiety was and how it wastes you. I had to learn. You know, somebody told me, listen, when you're out there, relax, whether you're wrestling or whether you're riding a horse. And don't forget to breathe. You have to breathe. You know, same way horses. They have to breathe.
Yeah,
I love when a horse would come to the head of the stretch and you could feel the girth expand.
They swell up.
Yep. Your legs. They take that deep breath and then they go, and they let it out, and then they take another one and they take off again. That's what a good natural athlete as a horse does. They breathe. And they have ability, of course.
Now, you know, this is a couple of things there that really register, and you know, that puffing up that, you know, you hear guys talk about that they, you know, they feel the horse, you know, swell under you, and you feel that with your knees.
Yeah, and you know what? All that stuff that goes over your head when you first start, because you're so conscious of trying to be a jockey that you forget you're on a horse, that you're performing with him. You're not performing on him. You're performing with him. When you become a combined with his, you know, his mindset, you can feel what you got underneath you through your hands, the bit, and you're paying attention to where what his ears are doing, where his eyes are. If you can see him and he doesn't have blinkers on, you know, you can see the back of their eyes. And you can feel underneath you their stride, and then you can hear them take that deep breath, and you can feel up with your knees against his body and the girth expand, and he takes that deep breath. then you're becoming an aware jockey, a guy that's really knowing what he's feeling and what his horse is doing underneath of him. And then, I mean, you know, the old guys, the old timers, you know, like Chris Rogers and them guys that I came around with, Walter Blum, you know, guys like that. You got to develop hands on a horse, son. You got to have good hands. Well, that meant it wasn't strengthening your shoulders and legs and your knees, pulling back on this horse to slow him down. It was a way of using your hands to either restrain to some point, but also relax. Him and you relax as one. Believe me, you might have horse at the head of the stretch and you might run past these leaders. Or you might be on the lead when you uncock your stick and ask him to run. He's going to re-break underneath you. There's no better feeling. The greatest feeling in the world for a jock is you've been on the lead, you're kind of going along, and everybody thinks they got you, and they come to you at the quarter pole, 3/16 pole, and you go...
And spurt away.
You wave the stick and you're up 2 or 3. Hey, suckers. Look at me now.
Well, goodbye, Charlie, as George Wolf said to Charlie Kurtzinger. Goodbye, Charlie. So long, Johnny. Charlie. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Too funny. Epic. Tony, this was great. Tremendous.
It's always a pleasure, Steve. You keep up the good work, and you certainly entertained me today when I got done galloping horses, listening to you and to Russo and to Haskin. I've enjoyed your segment tremendously today, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Always great. The one and only Anthony Black, born in Mount Holly, New Jersey. I won't tell you his social security number, even though it's really easy to remember.
1951, I was born in Mount Holly Hospital, New Jersey.
I'm looking at your social security number. It's the easiest to remember. It's easier than mine.
They knew when they gave it to me, I wasn't too smart, so they better not
be able to get it. Unbelievable. He's the greatest. Tony Black, everybody. We got to wrap it up. 3 o'clock, HRRN coverage. I love it. Nicole Russo and Dick Powell today and Steve Haskin and Tony Black. We kind of ran over for Rich Eng and getting Seth Merrow back in here. Tomorrow, weekend preview and lots of the state bred programs and Far Hills and more. Doug O'Neill is going to join us. Sean Clancy, Tom Herman. Gus Alonso with a visit. We're going to do a little pre-Breeders' Cup work with Gus. All right. Plus the usual DRF roundup. Little Jay Pridman and Marty McGee and Mike Welch. There you go. There's your show tomorrow. Replay 6 to 9 here on Sirius XM. Talk to you live at 9. Good luck today, everybody.